Our next guest, Sportsnet in Montreal. We've had him on numerous times here over the last couple of months as Flames fans hoping that they could hunt down the Habs. It did not happen, and they're still going. Seems like a long time. Eric Engels joins us this morning. Good morning, Eric. How are you?
Doing great, guys. How are you?
I'm good. This is my guess. You work through a pandemic. The Habs get to the playoffs. It's all very exciting. 2,500 fans, then 3,500 fans. But for Eric Engels, now you're not in Vegas, are you?
No, I'm not. You know, the quarantine issue has not been resolved quite yet. And for me to be able to travel back and forth would have been pretty much impossible. So we decided it was more important for me to be in Montreal. And if the Canadians are able to get through this round and over to the Stanley Cup final, potentially things change by then. Yeah, so we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Because I see Sean McKenzie's down there, and I'm thinking, you know, maybe if we need to, you know, because things happen in Vegas, right? If maybe Sean comes down with a bad cold or something, we could, because I know some people down there. We can make some things happen if we need to get you down there, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, I think Sean is there, and Sean is going to stay there. You know, yeah. It was the traveling back and forth issue, but I know what you mean.
Is that not the what a terrible phone call that is from head office? Listen, we're going to need to send you to Vegas, but you're going to have to stay there even when the series shifts back. So we're looking maybe 9-10 days, perhaps, in Vegas.
Set up shop, get comfy, and we're going to make it your home base for a bit. So get comfy.
Vegas is a small doses kind of place, all right? If you're there for 3-4 days, that's perfect. If you're there for a week or longer, you know, the chances that something bad will happen to you moving along are get increasingly better.
It can be, yeah. It's
exponentially, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, it can be. Let's,
if it gets on a live, I'll be happy for you.
I want to get your impressions on game number one, because I thought it was a great start for the Canadians in period one, and then, man, they get back to within one, and that goal less than a minute later, it really seemed to take the wind out of the sails. But you watch it, obviously, closer than we do. What did you see out of Montreal from two nights ago?
I actually think you really nailed it. I think it's funny, people were looking at the fact that the Canadians surrendered the lead. It's not as if they've never been able to win a game without doing that, but yes, they had won 7 in a row without doing it, and I think everyone would have looked at that as the kiss of death. Excuse me. But it was really that third goal that killed them. You know, they were back in the game when Caulfield scored, and that third goal, you know, kind of plinkoed its way to Janmark's stick, and that was a killer. So, you know, you look at the way Vegas played, I thought they were dynamic from the second period on and through the third period. Physical, aggressive, very good at limiting the rush opportunities. And Montreal, you know, They played a really strong, aggressive first period and sat back a bit after that, and that hurt them. And I thought, you know, there was a few mistakes made. Vegas did a great job attacking the weaker links on the defense with Jeff Petrie out. And, you know, the Canadians didn't respond all that well to Vegas's defense being as active, not only in the rush, but in the offensive zone. So a couple faceoff plays cost them goals where, you know, you can't lose faceoffs clean in your own zone, you know, and that's why you probably shouldn't try to win them completely clean. I think you got to do a better job of tying up your man, and that gives your wingers an opportunity to flash out to the points and cut down the set plays. And I think those are little adjustments that the Canadians can make going into the next one. And so long as they have the same start that they had, even if it doesn't produce the first goal, it will set the tone for them. And this is, as everyone knows, a critical game for them. They'd love to go back to Montreal with a split. They say you haven't lost anything until you lose a game on home ice, but let's be honest, you know, this Vegas team is a powerhouse. They've won a bunch of games in a row. They're playing great hockey, and the Canadians have to halt their momentum and see some of their own going back to Montreal.
This is kind of a goes without saying kind of statement, but you could see the loss of Petrie, because Weber and Sherratt both played north of 25 minutes the other night, Edmondson just over 20, and then it's a drop down to Kulak and Gustafson. So it's not just the quality of play you're getting from Petrie, but it's replacing what I would guess would be in that 20 to 25 minute range. What's, from where your vantage point, what's the likelihood of him getting back in? How close? And is there any change? Because I want to ask you about Romanov as well, but I know that Merrill might be available. Any changes on the back end, do you think? And just thoughts without Petrie, what that means.
Yeah, it's purely speculative at this point. I don't think we'll get an answer this morning, at least or this afternoon, Vegas time. But, you know, I even if he can play, how effective can he be? You know, there's things that he can do. Obviously, his skating won't be affected. His wind won't be affected. His energy shouldn't be affected. But his ability to shoot and pass the puck would naturally be affected. And I don't think it's a secret at this point that he hurt his right hand and probably the last two fingers that have been taped together and thrown into this special kind of glove that he's wearing right now. You know, athletes never cease to amaze me, especially hockey players, in terms of what they're able to do and the type of pain they're able to play through. But this is tricky. And I really wonder if he wasn't able to play in game one, how effective he could be in game two. We know he can be better than what we saw from the guys you mentioned there that were replacing him. But, you know, he's vulnerable out there with an injury that everyone knows about, and it's a tricky situation. So hopefully if he's able to play, he's able to be effective. And, you know, the Canadians might get a boost just from having his presence out there and from him being able to do the things that he can do. So it's I know it's kind of a wishy-washy answer, but I guess we'll see what the story is. But if he doesn't play, you know, I don't think anyone could look at him and say, well, you know, he should have gone in there, the urgency of the situation. I mean, it's brutal what happened to him. It's incredibly unlucky. You think about all the plays he could have gotten hurt on for him to post his hand up on the glass and get it stuck in the slot that the photographer throws his camera through. I mean, that's just terrible luck. And, you know, you hope for the player himself that he's feeling better and he's doing okay, because I'm sure he's dying to get in there and play and help his teammates. So, it's the main storyline going into game two, no question about it. And I think we'll have to wait till warm up to get a better sense of what his status is going to be.
Eric Engel's our guest out of Montreal tonight, the Habs and the Golden Knights game two here on Sportsnet. Ryan?
Eric, one of the major storylines of the series has been the Pacioretty for Suzuki and Tatar swap. Take us back to 2018. What was the context of that deal? Because I know right now, I don't know whether it's revisionist history or just people telling different stories. Give us your insights on what actually was happening and what the impetus for that trade was for both sides.
Well, the relationship between Max Pacioretty and the Canadians had soured. You know, he followed up a 35-goal season with no goals in the playoffs against the New York Rangers, and then had 17 goals at career low, basically, and just wasn't able to play the way he wanted, and the Canadians cratered to the bottom of the standings. And it seemed clear that his leadership was impugned by management. And, you know, his name was heavily involved in rumors throughout the entire season. And then he was traded at the draft to Los Angeles. There was, you know, reports later on that he had asked for a trade. He denied ever asking for a trade. Jeff Molson said that he absolutely did ask for a trade. I think Pacioretty felt like, you know, he was being offered to people left, right, and center, and inevitably had a meeting with Mark Bergevin and said, hey, if you're thinking of trading me, then just trade me. You know, like, so it all became quite sour and quite a bad situation, to the point that everyone knew that Mark Bergevin had to trade this guy after he nagged a deal to Los Angeles at the draft. You wondered, you know, what are they going to get? He's had four 30-goal seasons in a row and followed up with this bad output over a year. You know, he's not getting younger. He needs a new contract within a year. What will Mark Bergevin be able to unearth in this deal? And we showed up to the Canadiens golf tournament for the following season, and Mark Bergevin came out and announced that he had traded Pacioretty to Vegas for Nick Suzuki, Thomas Tatar, and a second-round pick that inevitably was swapped for a third and a fifth, I believe, that became Matthias Norlander and Jacob Laguerre. So all to say, you know, I think on the day that the trade was made, I wrote for Sportsnet.ca that, you know, Mark Bergevin knocked it out of the park. You know, he was not in a leveraged position to get a good deal. And he ends up with not only Suzuki, but Tatar comes over to the Canadiens. And if he could be anywhere near the player that he was in Detroit after, you know, a failed experiment in Vegas, that'll be a success. And Suzuki has great promise and has already shown it, you know, with a 100-point season in the OHL, and he'll go back there and continue to hone his craft and potentially become a very good centerman for this team. And, you know, the second-round pick is a nice little bonus, and that it turns into a guy like Matthias Norlander, who's a very talented prospect that is going to make you just signed with the Canadiens and has a chance to potentially make their team next year. Well, that's the cherry on top. And you look at the way it's evolved. Suzuki has been fantastic. You know, he went back to junior, killed it there, came up to the Canadians, and has progressed every step along the way and is evolving into a number one center, if he's not one already. And Tatar led the Canadians in scoring for 2 years in a row after a bit of a, you know, an up and down one this season, but still he's delivered the goods. And Pacioretty, watching him in Vegas, you know, for all the great seasons he had in Montreal, and he had a 39 goal season here, he has played the best hockey of his life there. He has really been phenomenal. The synergy that he's found with Mark Stone has been great, and he has completely undone the narrative that he can't perform in the playoffs, which dogged him his entire time in Montreal. You know, he's got 30 points, he's got 27 points in 31 games, I believe, in the playoffs with Vegas, and 14 goals, and he's just been fantastic. And game one actually broke a scoring streak that he was on from the minute he got into the playoffs from game seven in their first series against Minnesota. So it's been a trade that's worked out well for both teams, and yet here it is in the spotlight. And you know, if Suzuki outperforms him and the Canadians move on, it will be a part of the evaluation, and vice versa. So it's a really, really interesting dynamic to the series.
Yeah, no question. The other one is that, whether it feels like it's coming up or not, next winter is an Olympic one with Beijing hosting the Winter Games. Team Canada is supposed to be sending the big boys. I think we see both these goalies on that roster, which seems wild given their age and maybe where confidence was in both of these respective netminders at times over the last few years.
Oh, yeah. No question about it. I think, you know, the guy in Montreal's net is likely to be the starter, and Marc-Andre Fleury right behind him. And you can pick a third out of a handful of guys. Jordan Binnington's Canadian, right?
His name's in there, yep.
Yeah, so his name would be in there. Great story. Great to see these guys matching up against each other. They both have great respect for each other. They know each other pretty well. The incredible part of it for me is the contrast in styles and how they do what they do, and how Fleury is this outgoing, bubbly personality and Price is this quiet, calm, cool dude. And that shows in the way they play the position. And I think what's interesting about that and how different they are is that their leadership is still as valued in one place or the other. You know, they're different types of leaders, but Carey Price is unquestionably the guy in Montreal, not just for the way he plays. You know, he is the steadying, calm presence in the room as well for the Canadians. And Fleury is that keep everybody loose, funny, trash talking goalie, total character. And it's great to see them on the big stage battling this out. And you know what this means to them. And, you know, Fleury has three cups, but only one of them is the starting goaltender. And this means a lot to him, obviously. At his age, who knows how many other chances he'll get. And for Price, he's playing for his first one and behind a team that's probably better than any of the ones that he's played behind before, maybe with the exception of the 2014 team that, unfortunately, that chance was stolen away from him when Chris Kreider went skates up into his leg and busted his knee. So this is the other side of the other headline event in this series. And it lived up to the bill in game one. Fleury was phenomenal, and Price was too, despite allowing four goals. So look for more of that moving forward.
Enjoy it, man. We're jealous. It'd be great to still be covering hockey here. And it does feel like a big one, right? I know that a series isn't over until, like you say, you lose at home, but man, an 0-2 hole against any team, but certainly it feels like Vegas with that crowd and all of that is going to be a big one. The last one I had for you, I saw Caulfield 15-43 the other night. Do you want more of Cole Caulfield, or are you happy with his utilization?
No, I think his utilization is perfect, and the Canadians are best off when they're playing in balance and rhythm. So, you know, that's been the winning recipe for them in these playoffs. And I think it has to be the recipe for them, especially against the Vegas Golden Knights team that rolls four lines deep and six defensemen. You have to be able to play the game at a tempo that is significantly higher. Everything is raised up. Caulfield is playing great. You know, that he only scored his first goal in the last game is not indicative of the way he has played. He's wise beyond his years. He's a really smart player. Anyone who thought that, he's just a sniper, I think he's proven a lot of that wrong. I think he's an elite thinker of the game. I think he really puts himself in really smart positions, and not just in the offensive zone where his bread and butter, you know, where his bread gets buttered, I should say. He's great all over the ice, and he's a great playmaker, and he's smart defensively, and he's really adapting well. And Dominic Ducharme talking about the fact that every time they give him a little note, you see it applied on his next shift. So this is a smart, capable player who's, I think, going to become a star in this league. And I have no issue with the way he's being used right now. He's been used, you know, all over in all situations, and specifically on the power play too. So it's all gravy for him.
Thank you, Eric. Enjoy the game tonight. Thanks for your time.
You too, guys. Take care.